with this set of lectures on integrability in gauge gravity duality. So let me start by a brief summary of what we saw the last times. I understood that maybe I was a bit fast, so please tell me, please ask me to slow down in case I'm going very fast. So let me recall what we did first. We understood that if we could renormalize the operators, the multiplicative renormalization of the operators was related to the anomalous dimension of those operators. And the anomalous dimension was the basic building block of a conformal field theory. It tells you how two-point functions behave. So we started renormalizing states, which were the following. They were in n equals 4 super Young Mill trace of scalars, phi i1, phi i2, up to phi il, where the polarization of the scalar can go from 1 to 6. And we had such single trace operators. Now, such single trace operators, so I can look at them, I can represent them in this notation. I have a line, and here is the scalar I1, scalar with polarization I2, etc., up to the scalar with polarization IL. I can, of course, also draw them in a circle, because there is a trace, and I can draw this I1, I2, etc., up to IL. This is just alternative representations that I will use throughout the lecture. And I can also, and this was the last point, represent it as a spin chain ket, a ket of a quantum spin chain. This is just a question of notation. I just say that I put here I1 up to IL inside the ket. And this, all this is alternative notations for the kind of states that we studied. Okay, then we saw that if we considered one loop diagrams, if we had the scalar down here, I1, I2, etc., IN, IN plus 1, here are two neighbors, etc., up to IL, and we started computing this one loop diagram, such as this one, with the scalars which exchange the color, plus dot, 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 we obtained a log divergence. Let me put here a plus sign. And then the divergence depends on the indices which are up here and on the indices which are down here. So they must be almost equal, because if they are very different, there is no way to make weak contractions and to get non-zero. But these two guys here can differ. The pairwise indices can differ. And okay, the divergence is different for different choice of indices, and this is parameterized by this matrix H. And again, this H contains lots of delta functions. I1 must be equal to J1, I2 to J2, etc., except for two neighbors. Otherwise, they must all be equal because we are only doing one loop computations. What does this imply? This implies that if I define an operator, which is my bare operator, minus now instead of plus, minus, log lambda times H acting on another bare operator with J1 up to JL in this way, this guy is finite. Why is he finite? Because when I put there the probes now up here, and I compute the one loop diagram here, I get plus log lambda. But I have here minus log lambda times this guy, which cancels when I just do the free weak contractions here. So the free weak contractions of this guy cancel with the one loop divergences of this guy here. So this is precisely how we renormalize. We engineer the operator so that I get finite results as the cutoff goes to infinity. And this is nothing. This combination here is nothing but e to the minus h log lambda, this matrix. This is a matrix with indices I1 up to IL, J1 up to JL, acting on this guy. Any question here about why this is finite? And about the computation of this H? Now, if we choose an operator which is an eigenvalue of H, then we have an eigenstate. We have a state psi. We work now in this notation where operators are seen as quantum spin chains. Then this matrix H, we thought, took this form. As I said, only nearest neighbors can change. And this is because why we have a local Hamiltonian. There is a sum from n equal 1 up to L. I call it Hamiltonian just because I want to. So I sum over the L sites of the spin chain. And there is the identity, the permutation, and the trace acting on sites n and n plus 1. The eigenstates, so if I can find the operators which diagonalize this Hamiltonian, the eigenstates, according to this notation map, correspond to the operators which have an anomalous dimension which is well defined and which is the energy of the corresponding state. So our goal now is to understand why can we compute the energy of such Hamiltonians. I also mentioned that there is a sector which is quite important, which is the SU2 sector, where you construct scalars phi1 plus i phi2, phi3 plus i phi4. You think of it as spin up and spin down, and then in that sector, the Hamiltonian is just the usual Heisenberg Hamiltonian. Questions so far? Any question about the previous lecture? Okay, so you might wonder, okay, what we did was the very beginning of understanding how one-dimensional integral models arise in four-dimensional theories, because we found a one-dimensional quantum spin chain arising from a computation in a four-dimensional gauge theory. And it turns out that this spin chain is integrable. Now, this four-dimensional field theory is much richer than only scalars. It contains scalars, fermions, derivatives, whatever. So you might ask, what happens if instead of considering just operators with scalars, if I start putting gluons and fermions, etc.? Well, then I will get a more complicated spin chain. The spin chain will not be an SO6 spin chain. It will be a spin chain whose symmetry is the symmetry of the underlying theory. And this turns out to be a symmetry which is based on a group instead of SO6, PSU2,2/4, which I might, if I have time, explain at some point. But whatever, it's some bigger group. You might also, and it turned out to also be integrable. You might also ask, what about higher loops instead of one loop? As we said, if we have higher loops, we don't have only nearest neighbor interactions, because now the interactions can go further. You can have an extra loop and go one side further. We have next to nearest neighbor interactions. So we start having Hamiltonians, which have this huge symmetry, and whose range increases in perturbation theory. There is no evidence so far that the model is not completely integrable at any order in perturbation theory in any sector that you might consider. And this is why n equals 4 is so special, or one of the reasons why it is so special, because of this structure. And if you ask me a priori, looking at the Lagrangian, why would I guess that I would find this remarkable integrability structure, no one knows the answer to. So far, it's a curious observation, a miracle if you want. And it is very tied up to the fact that there is an EDS-CFT duality, because from the string theory point of view, there I understand why the string theory dual is integrable. And therefore, if I do believe the duality, then indeed I have an explanation about why n equals 4 is integrable. But it's one case where without the duality, no, there is no natural explanation, purely within the gauge theory, of why we have an integrable theory. What is an integrable theory? In 1 plus 1 dimension, which is what we are now considering, we have a spin chain in 1 dimension. In 1 plus 1 dimension, when we scatter two momenta, two particles with momenta p1 and p2, we get two other particles. Let's assume that the collision is elastic, which must be equal to the original particles. Why is that? Momentum is conserved, and let's call momenta q1, which is sum of pj, j equal 1, up to 2 in this case. Let's call 2m. But that's not enough. Energy is also conserved. If momentum was conserved, I don't know that the set of momenta is equal to the original set of momenta. I only know that p1 prime plus p2 prime is p1 plus p2. So it's also important, not only that q1, but that q2 exists, which is sum over pj squared. Well, what if I scatter three particles in 1 plus 1 dimension? If I scatter three particles, I have p1 after the collision, I get p1 prime, p2 prime, and p3 prime. And a priori, this is not equal to p1, p2, and p3, right? It's not, because I only have energy and momentum conservation. Now, it is equal, so it is not equal, unless we have, for some strange reason, an exotic charge, q3, which is something like, for example, pj cube. If we also have the sum of pj cube for some reason, then indeed conservation of these three charges implies that the set of momenta is the same, and not only that the total energy and momenta is the same. So if this is the case, you would conclude, if you would be an experimentalist and if you would observe a set of three momenta being the same at plus and minus infinity, you would conclude that in the experiment, the particles effectively only scattered in a pairwise manner. Because when they scatter in a pairwise manner, their momenta are at most exchanged. So if all collisions in the bulk are pairwise, then if I start from something at minus infinity, I end with something at plus infinity, which is just a permutation. How can I understand this a bit more mathematically? I can consider three wave packets which are going to scatter, which I prepare, which I'm going to scatter in the same point in space. This is clearly, or it's not a pairwise scatter. So this is something, okay, some wave function, which is something like, let's put some momenta centered around some p0, and then you have some p0 x minus x0 plus p0 square t minus t0 over 2. Okay, p. Let me put p. P or p0 is basically the same because I am in, because, I mean, I assume I have a Gaussian which fixes p to be p0. So I have a particle, they have some well-defined momenta, and this phase, the stationary phase, tells me that for this wave packet, I have x minus x0 plus p times t minus t0 equals 0, which is, of course, the trajectory when I start at a point in space-time and go. I'll sum this point t0, x0. Okay. What happens if I apply to my wave function, if I apply the operator e to the I kn, I apply it to my wave function? Well, in Fourier space, this charge qn is very simple. It is just p to the n, right? So what it does, it just adds here, so let me write in a different color. The only difference is that, okay, let me add with a parameter alpha, a transformation with a parameter alpha. I just get here plus alpha p to the n in the new wave function. In Fourier, this is just multiplication by e to the ip. And therefore, this stationary phase condition, I get an extra term, which is plus alpha p to the n minus 1 times n. I get this extra term when I compute the stationary phase. So what happens when n is equal to 1? When n is equal to 1, n is equal to 1, it means that I'm basically, I can think of this transformation as shifting, when n is equal to 1, there is nothing here, as shifting x, 0. When n is equal to 2, I can think of this transformation as a shift of t, 0. Does this make sense? It does, because when I have n equal to 1, I'm applying the momenta transformation, I'm shifting space. When I have n equals to 2, I am using the energy, so I'm shifting time. But if n is equal to 3, I'm shifting my wave packets. By a momentum-dependent quantity. What is the implication of this statement? The implication is the following. If I have a charge, e to the I alpha q3, for example, and I add with this charge here, the amplitude for this process, if this is a symmetry, is the same. This is the definition of a symmetry. I apply a symmetry transformation, and I get the same probability amplitude. So if q3 is conserved, I can apply this charge q3 to this process to get a process which has the same probability amplitude. But what will q3 do to each wave packet? It will shift the wave packet by a quantity which depends on the momentum of the wave packet. And therefore, what I will get is something like this. So theories where I have an extra particle, an extra charge q3, an extra nonlinear charge apart from the momentum and the energy, I can use this extra charge to shift my particles by quantities which depend on their momenta. And therefore, the scattering, the three-body scattering, is a sequence of two-body scatterings. Furthermore, this could be, for example, for alpha positive. If I would do alpha negative, I would get that the scattering is also equivalent to this scattering process. So I see that in integrable theory, in theories where I have these extra charges, this is what I mean by an integrable theory. When these extra charges exist, two things happen. The scattering factorizes. The three-body scattering factorizes into a sequence of two-body scatterings. And actually, the two-body S matrices, they obey this relation, which is called this one here. It's called Young-Baxter relation. Why do I call this an equation? Because imagine these particles, they have colors. Then the scattering matrices are matrices. So this is a relation which tells me that if I scatter, I have this S matrix times this S matrix times this S matrix is equal to the product of S matrices in the opposite order. So this can sometimes be a powerful constraint on S matrices of theories which I know to be integrable. Because I know that for this theory, the scattering must factorize and must obey this kind of relation. But I'm jumping slightly ahead. What I wanted to convey is the idea that the existence of extra conserved charges, my expectation was that it should mean that the particles are effectively only scattering in a pairwise way, because it implies that the moment, the individual moment are conserved. And indeed, this is backed up by an explicit computation where I check that by applying this extra charge to a wave packet, I shift it by an amount which depends on the momenta. And therefore, if I have three different momenta, P1, P2, and P3, the shift of each wave packet will be different, and they will no longer scatter in the same position. And the amplitude for this process is the same as the amplitude for this process, because Q is a symmetry. Yes?
So why do you want the three-body problem to be integrable?
Why do I want, why do I want this relation to hold? Why do I want to have an equal here? Okay, so the idea is that these theories, an integrable theory, what is an integrable theory? An integrable theory is one where the scattering factorizes. This is a huge simplification. It means that if you want to study any scattering process, you only need to study two-body scattering processes. So this is the next to the simplest after the free theory. So free theories is for babies. But now you have integrable theories, which is the exactly solvable, the realm of exactly solvable models. So integrable theories are those for which the theory is not trivial, there is an S matrix, but you only need to know the two-body S matrix. You only need to know how two bodies scatter with two bodies, and that's enough. Because then three bodies, four bodies, etc., you obtain from factorization. Any question here? Now, so what we want to understand now is why is this theory integrable? Why? In this case, where are these extra charges Q? Where is this Q3, Q4, Q5? Where are these charges in the Heisenberg model, which are responsible for this miracle that n equals 4 turns out to be described by an integrable model? Okay, but before doing that, let me try to, let me just explain. What happens when the model is integrable? When the model is integrable, you can understand what's the spectrum of the model when I put it in a very big circle, when L is very large. And I have some particles here with momenta P1 up to Pm. M particles. Now, if the particles were free, how do you compute the spectrum? Well, you quantize them. You say that e to the I pj times l is equal to 1. You quantize each of the particles in the box, in the circle. You say that the wave function, the phase acquired by the wave function is 1. And then the energy is equal to the sum of the dispersion relation of each particle pj for j equal 1 up to n. This is for a free theory. Okay? Any question here? Is this clear to everyone? Epsilon fp can be p squared over 2 if the model, if it's if it's quantum mechanics, it can be square root of p squared plus m squared if it is quantum field theory, whatever. Yeah? Is this clear? Very good. What happens in an integrable theory instead of a field theory? What happens is that when you pick a particle and carry it throughout the ring, okay? The total phase is not the free propagation. The particle will meet other particles. It will meet this one, this one, this one, and this one. When it meets each particle, it acquires a phase shift. You have the wave function, it passes by a particle, and it gets a phase shift. But because the model is integrable, the total phase shift is a sequence of phase shifts by meeting each of the other particles, because the scattering factorizes. So because the scattering factorizes, I can correct this equation by saying that there is a product. When the particle meets all other particles, so I put here k is not equal to j, and then there is a phase shift, a two-body phase shift, which I can compute with momentum pj, where particle pj scatters with particle pk. So I just need to compute the two-body S matrix, and then I can immediately write down bit equations in this form. And this is the goal of the exercise that you have for this afternoon, which is to solve the one-body and two-body problem for the spin chain. By solving the one-body problem, you understand what's the energy of one particle. You understand what is epsilon. By solving the two-body problem, when you put two magnets moving in this spin chain, two spin fleets moving in this plane, you understand what is S. And therefore, you can write down, because the model is integrable, immediately bit equations. OK? Yes? By particles, I will say now what I mean. So by particles in the spin chain, very good. I noticed when I said magnet that I should not have mentioned. By particle in the spin chain, what do I mean by a particle with momentum p? I mean that I have spin up, up, and then I have a spin down. Here, this is at position n. I make e to the I p n, and I sum over n. And this is what I mean by a magnet or particle with momentum p. So it's an excitation which moves in the spin chain. It's the analog of a particle which just moves in a free circle, and it moves here with p. Now I think of these spin ups as being some vacuum, and then the spin flip or spin down is the particle which moves in this vacuum of spin up. OK? Just a question of how to interpret this. This is what I mean by a particle. OK. So, yeah.
Do these particles relate to the behavior of the operators in a single trace?
So we will see. So the idea then is that, very good. So let me relate to the problem of the problem of the spectrum of n equals 4 Cyprian wheels. The idea is precisely that you have this Hamiltonian. So if you have one magnet, or let's put n magnets, it means that we are considering operators which are built out of trace of z to the j times x to the m. You have m spins down, j spin up, plus, of course, permutations, because they mix under the Hamiltonian. These are the operators. And the anomalous dimensions of these operators are the energies of the spin chain, which are given by that expression. So if you solve the bit equations for m particles, you are computing anomalous dimensions of operators in n equals 4 supersymmetric gauge theory with m complex scalars x and some other complex scalars, z, which tells you what's the size of the spin chain. OK? So the size is related to the number of its x, its z. The size is related to how many fields in total you have. The m is related to the number of particles. So by solving these equations with L and m, you are computing the spectrum of all such operators in n equals 4 Cyprian wheels instead of doing Feynman diagrams. OK? Very good. So any question here so far? So let us understand. So this is the answer to the one loop. This is the equation which give the one loop anomalous dimensions. You should compute explicitly what this S is and what this epsilon of P is for this spin chain. This you will do in the exercise. But a priori now, with these formulas here, these two, you can compute the anomalous dimension of any operator at one loop, of course. Now, let's understand why these models are integrable. So where are these extra charges Qn for these models? So any, if there is no question so far, I will move to this treatment, which is a bit I wouldn't say harder, but it's a bit more abstract than what we have seen so far. So, okay, so let's see. So first of all, our Hilbert space of our spin chain is a tensor product. There are L sides, so we have H1 up to HL. We are in SU2, so this H1, each of this H1 is isomorphic to C2, that's two components, up and down. And this is our Hilbert space. And we define an R matrix to be an object which has two indices, R, I, and J. Okay, sorry. So one more step. So we have this Hilbert space, and we also, let's also consider, it will be used later, an auxiliary space H0, which is also isomorphic to C2. So we have one C2 at each spin chain site, and we have also another H0, which we will use at some point. So each of these H, HI, all of them are isomorphic to C2. We define an R matrix, Rij, which is an operator, which depends on a complex number U. This U is a complex number, and it's called the spectral parameter. And this operator is an operator which acts on two of these spaces, HI times HA. It is a map on HI times HA to HI times HA. So I represent this operator as a line like this, where I have here I, J, I can put some arrows like this, and I can put some U here and 0 here, and the difference between the two lines is the argument of the function. Then, so this is just a definition of an R matrix, and I will tell you later what this R matrix should satisfy, what kind of relations I want for this R matrix. But let's first introduce a couple of definitions. So R matrix is the first one. Then I have the so-called monodromy matrix. So try to understand the notation. Of course, the physical meaning of these objects will become clear only a bit later. And the monodromy matrix. And this is some operator L, which also depends on U, which is the following. It's R0L of U, R0L minus 1 of U, tak, 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 R01 of U. So how do you represent, for example, this operator? So the way you could represent is by having, this is 1, 0. So I can have here the space 1, here the auxiliary space 0. Then I have 2, 0. That's this one, 2, 0, etc. I continue to multiply these R matrices, which live in two spaces, and I multiply them in one of the spaces, and this is the object. So this is what this L is, a product of these R matrices. As many R matrices as the number of the sides of the spin chain that I want to consider. Again, just definitions. I have one more definition, and then I'll start to extract some juice out of this. But please tell me if the definition is not clear, if you don't understand what I mean, if you want me to write some indices explicitly or whatever.
Yeah. So what space does this L matrix act on?
This matrix, so let's first R. R is a matrix which has four indices, two initial indices and two final indices. This L, this guy here is multiplied, this index, but I have 1, 2, and then plus 2L. I have 2L plus 2 indices 3. So it's a matrix with a huge number of indices 3. Right? So it acts on the auxiliary space and on all the contact spaces. So that's a very good point. So this guy, L, as Eric said, it acts on H0 times H1 times etc. times HL. It has all indices open, as you see in this picture, and it maps it to the same thing. H0 times H1 times HL. I can think of these indices here, for example, as the incoming indices, and then these ones as the outgoing indices. So this is an operator which acts on a huge more than the Hilbert space, on the Hilbert space and the auxiliary space. Next, and lastly, I have the transfer matrix. Which is the trace over the auxiliary space 0 of this matrix L of U. Okay? So how to draw this graphically? So I make the trace. So it means that I have the L matrix, and then I make the trace. I pick this particle, and I connect it. And you see that it starts to remind the picture that I have been drawing so far, where I have a closed spin. So this was the space 0. I took the trace. So now I still have these indices. If you want me, I can draw the indices here. I1, I2, up to IL, JL, J1, J2. So this operator, it acts on the Hilbert space into the Hilbert space. This is something that you might like because you like operator that checked on the Hilbert space times the Hilbert space. Okay? So these are the definitions that I need to include. And what do I need to impose? Of course, you can find me many objects which act on two spaces into two spaces, and then you can construct the L, and then you can construct the T. What do I need to impose on the R matrix? So what we want, and it will become clear why this is very important, we want that the R matrix obeys Young-Baxter. So we want that if I multiply the R matrices, I have here space HI, HJ, HK, it acts on three spaces, the product of three R matrices, I want this relation to be equal to this relation. So let me write a bit more explicitly what I mean. I mean that I want R 1, 2, it acts on space 1 and 2 with some spectral parameter U, times R 1 and 3 with spectral parameter U plus W, times R 2 and 3 with spectral parameter W, it's equal to the same thing written in the opposite order, R 2, 3 of W, R 1, 3 of U plus W, R 1, 2 of U. So if I want to put the arrows here, I have U here, I have 0 here, and I have minus W here. And then according to that picture, you can read off this. And this is space 1, 2, and 3. Right. So this object here, I understand, for example, this R13, R23, I understand it, of course, as the identity in space 1, tensor product with R23, where this guy acts on 2 times 3. So that this relation is a relation which each side acts on 1 times 2 times 3 into 1 times 2 times 3. Yes?
Explain again the diagram for the R matrix and how the R, like what the U dependence of the R matrix is.
So there is, if I have two lines where one carries a complex number U and the other one carries a complex number 0, then the difference between them in counterclockwise way is what the argument of the R matrix is. So I have U coming here with an arrow, 0 coming here, so U minus 0 is U. So here, I have U coming in, 0 coming here, U minus 0 is U. Then I have U here, minus W here, U minus minus W is U plus W. And I get U plus W here. Then 0 minus minus W is W, and then I get W here. So if you see this U, 0, and minus W with this orientation, you see that you reconstruct the arguments of the functions here. Okay? Yeah? It's a graphical rule for assigning the argument of a function to a set of lines. The arrows tell me the orientation so that I know if it's U or minus U. And then I just make the difference of the values between which are coming in. Okay. So suppose I found an R matrix which acts on this space and which obeys this relation. Let's first see what the consequences would be, and then let's construct explicitly such operator. So first let's see the consequences of this. Can I write here? So first, let's see the consequences. And the consequences would be the following. If I find, let me think. Maybe I will start first by finding explicitly an R function. Otherwise, it's becoming too abstract. Okay, so in order not to become too abstract, let's find an explicit form of the R matrix. So we want an R matrix. So let's find an SU2 R matrix. So there are two objects which I can use if I want an R matrix to have SU2 symmetry. So if I wanted to commute with the generators of SU2, which act on spin on the product of two spaces, then it means that my R matrix must be made out of, if you want, the total spin, for example, or must be made out of projectors into the symmetric and the anti-symmetric representation when I fuse two spins on hop. And those can be written in terms of the identity and the permutator. In other words, the R matrix, R of U, must be equal to some function H of U times the identity plus some function F of U times the permutation. If I wanted to have SU2 symmetry. So if another way to say it is that if I want to build tensors with delta functions which are allowed in SU2, I have delta AB, delta A prime, B prime, or I can exchange the other two and then I get a permutation on the identity. I can build nothing else which makes sense from the tensorial point of view. A fancy way of saying that is that if I have something which has SU2 symmetry, I must construct it out of the projectors into symmetric and antisymmetric, which are just identity plus minus the permutation over two, of course. Because those projectors, when I project into one of these, either symmetric or antisymmetric, I am in the representation of spin 1 or spin 0, so of course it commutes with the symmetry of SU2, which don't take me out of the representation. Okay, so what are these functions H of F? I want to constrain them by imposing this Young-Baxter relation. Okay, so let's suppose I want to check this Young-Baxter, and I want to check whether this relation here is true. Let's choose some. This must be a true relation. Let's suppose that, let's call this relation Young-Baxter. Let's suppose I want to compute, if Young-Baxter is 0, I can compute the following. I can act, for example, on this state and project it into this state. Then you can check that all other possible elements of this relation are redundant once this one is 0. So we want to impose that this is equal to 0. So it means that I want to choose particular polarizations here. I want to put plus here, minus here, minus here, plus here, minus here, minus here, plus here, minus here, minus here, plus here, minus here, minus here. Is it clear? Okay. Sorry? What? We could choose, there are many ways to check in Baxter. One is to use just the algebra of permutation. P12 times P23 is P13, etc., and just multiply explicitly and see what you need. But if this relation is true, if this will be equal to this, it will be true whenever I act it on any ket, right? So I can act on the ket plus up minus minus and project it onto up minus minus. Any combination that I choose here and choose the same here and choose another one here, it must give 0. In particular, this combination turns out to be enough to fix the function. So you can choose any other. You can put the other polarization. But I'm choosing a relation which is true. I'm choosing one element. Yes?
Yeah. How do we know in what order to multiply these R represented diagrams?
So you see the way I draw them. I draw first R12. Which is this R. If the indexes enter here, they first interact before they interact with this guy here. Okay. So R12 is the first one. And then, after R12, there is this one, and then there is this one. So you see that the indices must pass by R12, then they must pass by this R13, and then they must pass by this R23.
But if you move the line a bit, then the other one's first.
No. No. The point is that this index here and these two, they give two indices here. If you write explicitly the indices, you see that these two lines get out, and then this line here first needs to interact with this one before interacting them. If you want, you don't want the picture, you can always use this.
put just the indices here, and then it's the attributes. Okay, so, but I don't like to run proxies. So what? Let's see what can happen here. So I have this pin up here. And now when it comes here, it can either be permuted with this pin down, or nothing can happen. So there are two possibilities. Let's draw this line in yellow here. So this line, this pin up, can do nothing, for example, and can chain, and this, and I can use the identity here. And then, but if I do that, then it means that here I must come back. All right? So this is one possibility where I multiply these objects and I pick the identity here, I pick the permutation here, and I pick the identity here. This way, this pin here can come to this position here. Now there is another possibility. Let's put here plus and draw this again, which is the possibility where the spin is permuted here and then is permuted here. Which means that I use the permutation here, I use the permutation here, and I use the identity here. These are the two possibilities where for this right-hand side. So what do they correspond to? Here I use the permutation, and identity. So when I use the permutation, I get a function f. So I get f of u. When I use the identity, I get a function h times h of u plus w, because this one is the one with u, this one is the one with u plus w, and this one here is the one with w, because it's 0 minus w, 0 minus w and u. So u minus 0 is u, u minus w is u plus w, 0 minus w is w. And then I have the permutation again, so I have f of w. So this is what this term here gives. So please tell me whether this is clear. I need to use the permutation, which is the f of u. Then here I need to pick the identity, which is h of u plus w. And then here I need to pick permutation, which is f of w. Is this clear? Now the second term, this one here, plus. So what do I get here? The identity, which is h of u. Then I get the permutation, which is f of u plus w. And then I get the identity again, which is h of w. This is what I get in the left-hand side. Okay? And now you could do the same in the right-hand side. There will be, again, two possible pictures. You get, again, two terms. And the final result is that these functions f and h must obey the following equation. Can I jump to the result without doing the intermediate steps? I think now it's conceptually clear, right? So what I get is that h of u plus w over h over f of u plus w is equal to h of u over f of u plus h of v over f of v. This is the constraint that I get from Young-Baxter. And I chose one particular choice of indices, but as I told you, there are several ways to do this exercise. One, I can just use the algebra of the piece and then just check that imposing Young-Baxter imposes this relation. The other one, I can plug other choices of spin and check that I get nothing new. I can plug in Mathematica the explicit form of the permutations and just check that I get this relation. There are many ways that I can do this. Okay. So I get this equation. What does it tell me? V is W. Good. What do I get from, what am I getting from this relation? What do you get from this functional relation? What is the function? So this h of u over f of u is a function with this property. That when I have the sum of two arguments, it's the sum of two functions. Which functions have this property? Exponential, no? So I think someone said linear.
not only linear. Okay, maybe I don't know what linear means, but A times U only, not with a constant, right? It must really be proportional to U. This is the definition of what a linear function is, basically, if you want. So it must be A times U, and since this is just a redefinition of U, a rescaling of U, let me say that this is, for example, U over I. It's just a choice of my normalization of what U is. But the point is that it must be linear. Now, I fix the ratio of the two functions, and this makes perfect sense because this relation does not allow me to fix the overall factor. It only allows me to fix the relative coefficient between the two terms. So the absolute one, I can choose myself. So I will choose the normalization so that R of U is given by I times identity plus U times the permutation over I plus U. I don't know if it's in, is it compatible with what we wrote? No, it is not, right? The ratio of the function is U, it's the opposite. So the U is here, and the I is here. Okay. So this is what we found. If we have this R matrix obeys Young-Baxter. The relative coefficient is U, is linear in U, and the overall coefficient, it was my choice. Now, why, so far, let's now connect to what we have seen before about Hamiltonians in N equals 4 super Young-Mills. Why is it relevant to have found this R matrix, which obeys Young-Baxter, which is an SU2 R matrix? So this is the SU2 R matrix. It's trivial. You can check in mathematics, for example, that it obeys Young-Baxter. Maybe it's the simplest way. Okay. Any questions so far? Now let me explain why this is a very interesting quantity. Because if you have an R matrix which obeys Young-Baxter, then let's draw the following pictures. Let's draw this pitch, these lines, crossing with these lines, and then this. So what is this? This is a huge number of R matrices being multiplied. Let me say that the physical spaces here, it's 1, 2, etc., L minus 1, L. So I have all the physical spaces. So what are these extra spaces that I have here? They are some auxiliary spaces. So I have 2 instead of 1 now. So let me call it, say, 0, 1, and here 0, 2. Okay. So what... Can you make this? Can you tell me what this expression, more precisely, what this expression is in terms of formulas and the objects that we have introduced so far? So what is this object here? Not P. I'm drawing this notation. So what is this object here? No one? This cross here. What's a cross? Cross in an R matrix. I have 2 spaces coming in, 2 spaces coming out. This is an R matrix. So what I mean by that cross is an R matrix which acts on 0, 1, and 0, 2. Okay? Let me put here some spectra, some arrows here. And I have 0 spectral parameter coming at each of these arrows. And then I have U here and V here. So that line there, it's R, 0, 1 of U minus V. That cross there, this cross here. And now what is this, the upper one and the lower one? Well, let me put the one up here and the two down here. So what is this object here? What is this object here, the lower one, this one? L. So that is L, but L is an object which acts on the Hilbert space, but also on the auxiliary space. So let's put some index O1, because it's L constructed using the auxiliary space 1, the lower one. And this is at spectral parameter U. What about this one here, up here?
Exactly. Same thing with O2, L, O2 with spectral parameter V. So this is what that picture there means. Notice that this guy acts on the auxiliary and the Hilbert space, and this acts on another auxiliary and also on the Hilbert space, and they are multiplied. And the fact that they are multiplied is the fact that these indices here, they are contracted. These lines here, they are contracted here in the middle. Is it clear? So this picture represents this object here. And now let's do something funny with this picture, which is if these lines, if all these crosses are R operator, R matrices, which obey Young-Baxter. So what I can now do, I can pick this guy and move it there using Young-Baxter, and I have now one on this side. This was just using Young-Baxter. Now, this is no longer this. Now I have an R matrix on the other side. It's something else. Now I can do a second time and move this to, etc. What do I get at the end of the day? At the end of the day, I can move all the lines to the right. And therefore, at the end, what I get is the following picture. I get this. And now all the lines, by using Young-Baxter L times, all the lines are now on this side. And again, this is the auxiliary space O1. This is the auxiliary space O2. So if I construct such objects built out of an R matrix, then this guy is equal to this object here, where now I have R, O1, O2 of U minus V times L, 0, 1 of U, L, 0, 2 of V. Just the opposite order. So I got this kind of relation, which is basically some dressed Young-Baxter for this L matrices. OK? Now, this relation implies, and this is the very relevant relation, that the commutator, maybe this is a bit fast. Okay, let me write it and then let's explain, that this T of U and T of V commute for different U's and V's. Recall that this T, what was this T? This T was the trace of this L. Right? And this was an object which acts on the Hilbert space into the Hilbert space. All these indices here are open and open there. Right? I hope that your quantum information courses are being useful, because with all these tensor products, for me, when I started learning, I noticed that it was not completely trivial, but for my colleagues who did quantum information, it was more or less simple. So I don't know. So OK, this is the relation that you get from this relation. So can someone tell me why before I show it in more detail? So the argument is the following. Let me multiply this relation. Let's call it LLR. And let's multiply this equation LLR by R minus 1, by the inverse of this R operator. OK? And then I get something which is L01, L02 is equal to R, L. Wait, here there is something wrong. 0201 is equal to R, 01. L02 times R minus 1. Yes?
Why did you change the order of 0201 and L0102?
Because here, the indices come in and they meet first L1, and then they meet L2 and they give something. Here, they first meet O2, and then they meet O1, and then they give something. So here they first meet O2, then they meet O1, and then the indices which are free, they interact through R. It's a good exercise at home to put all the indices in this relation. Now, this relation here, it's not that one, of course. What do I need to get T's from L's? I need to take the trace. And now I have two auxiliary spaces, 0, 1 and 0, 2. Okay? So this relation is a relation which lives on the, which has three indices on 0, 1 and three indices on 0, 2. There are these indices here which are free. So let me trace over them. Let me take the trace over the auxiliary space 1 times the auxiliary space 2. What is the trace of a tensor product of two things which live in different spaces? It's just a product of traces. So when I take the trace of this relation, on the left-hand side, I get t. So this guy, the first one, was at v. And this one was at u. So I get trace over the auxiliary space 2 of L in the auxiliary space 2 of V times trace in the auxiliary space 1 of L in the auxiliary space 1 of U. But this is nothing but T of V times T of U. I take the trace. It doesn't matter that if it, that it was called O2 or O1. It doesn't matter. It's the trace of an L operator. It's a T of V. The trace of another L operator. It's a T of U. What about the right-hand side? When I take the trace, R and R minus 1 cancel because the trace is cyclic. So before decomposing the trace into trace of one times trace of the other, I kill the R's. And then I split the trace. So on the right, on the other side, I get T of U, T of V because of cyclicity of the trace. And this relation is precisely the statement that the commutator is equal to 0. So we have now, if you have Young-Baxter, transfer matrices, which are objects which act on the quantum space into the quantum space, commute at different values of the spectral parameter. Okay, so you need to hold your breath for just one more minute, and now I will explain why this second box is nothing but the statement that we have this extra conserved charge. I hope I can do it in 5 minutes. So, first, we notice that our Hamiltonian is nothing but t minus 1 of 0 times the derivative with respect to u of this t of u at u equal to 0. That's the first statement that I want to make. Let's check this statement. What is t of 0? T of 0 is the trace of a product of R matrices at 0. What are the R matrices at 0? They are just the permutation operator. So I have a trace of P0L, P0L minus 1, etc., P01. That's what T of 0 is. So graphically, what this is I have my transfer matrix, and at each point, I have a permutation. So effectively, notice what I'm doing. The index 1 is going to position 2. The index 2 is going to position 3. The index 3 is going to position 4. All the indices are being shifted. And the last index is going to position 1. So this is the operator e to the ip, which shifts just the indices in this way, which acts on index i1 up to il in this way. And it gives these indices here. OK? So t of 0 is the inverse shift operator. It's a shift operator to the right. Its action is picking an index and shifting it in this way. Right? No, e to the I, no, sorry. This is another operator. This is not this P. This is e to the I momentum operator. How do you call momentum? Momentum normally it's P. E to the I momentum, because it's a shift operator by 1 unit. Okay, e to the I momentum, which is basically this speech. So this is the shift operator. What is this guy? What is t prime at 0? T prime at 0, it's also simple. Now I put it at 0, but I take the derivative. I have a product of R operators, and I take the derivative. So in one of them, when I take the derivative and I set it to 0, there are two options. Either the derivative acts here, or the derivative acts here. So this is equal to a trace. So most guys, they are untouched, P0L, P0L minus 1, etc. And then there is a guy here where the derivative acted. And then all other guys, they are not touched, up to P0, 1. So what do I get here? if the derivative acts on the U, then I get the identity operator. Okay, at side I get the identity operator here. If the derivative acts on the numerator, I get minus the permutation operator. So this is when the derivative acts on the numerator, and this is when the derivative acts on the denominator. Let's consider this one, because this one is the interesting one. This one gets a P, it gives the same, this one we already saw. It gives this shift there. So what about this one in the numerator? So let's consider this one. So this one, the picture is the following. I use the permutation everywhere, except at some point where I use the identity. Okay, so this is the picture for T prime of 0. T prime of 0 is equal to this minus the shift, the guy where I shift there. But there is this one here. And now let's multiply it by T minus 1 of 0. What is T minus 1? If T shifts everyone to the right, T minus 1 is the operator which is everyone by one unit to the left. So T minus 1 is basically the operator which shifts everyone to the left. So you see that here you shift everyone to the right, but then I act with T minus 1 which shifts everyone to the left. So the contribution of this term is just minus doing nothing. The last term. Here, of course, this is at position k. There is a sum over k. The derivative can act on site 1, site 2, etc. So here there is a sum over k. This is at position k. Okay? So the one where it does nothing is this one here, where this is position k. There is again a sum over k here. So t minus 1, which is equal to this, times t prime of 0. That's what I'm computing now. Okay? Be careful with notation. And now I have sum over k. And now when it acts here, what happens? Everyone is shifted to the right, and then I shift everyone to the left. I almost get to the same position, except because of this guy here. And if I do it carefully, what I see that I get is that no one is touched except two guys which are permuted. This is the net effect. And this is nothing but the sum over this permutation minus the identity at site k and k plus 1 that we had seen before. So we recover the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So this statement is true. The Heisenberg Hamiltonian is obtained from this thing. What does this imply then? Then this box, let's call it TT, then TT implies that we have an Hamiltonian H which commutes with some T, which is an operator which acts on the Hilbert space for any U. If T of U commutes with T of V, in particular, the derivative at 0 also commutes, etc., and H commutes with T at any complex number U. But this means that this is a conserved charge. But this conserved charge is a charge which depends on a complex number U. It's an operator which also depends on a complex number U. So if you expand this relation, it implies that H commuting with Q1 plus H commuting with Q2 times U, plus, if I expand in Taylor series, this relation, plus H commuting with Q3 times U square, plus etc., is equal to 0. And of course, since this is a relation which must hold for any U, it means that you have all these conserved charges, Q1, Q2, Q3, etc., from expanding this T matrix at any U that you might like, at U equals 0, at U equal whatever. So the fact that you have a conserved charge which depends on U, immediately implies that this Hamiltonian has a huge number of conserved charges. And therefore, the model is integrable, and therefore, you are able to find the spectrum as you will do in the exercise. Okay, thank you. Any questions?